Good morning, everyone. It's so nice to see all of you today. Welcome to week two of After Incarceration, Bending the Moral Arc Toward Justice in the Season of Juneteenth. Last week, we heard from Ian Jabril, who talked about the importance of education for those who are incarcerated or are re-entering after their incarceration period. And he noted that as a barber, when he worked during his carceral life in an institution, he heard many stories of trauma from his fellow incarcerated individuals. And he was overwhelmed by the power and the strength of these people. And it struck him, so he went on to work with the PD Green program. And today we're going to focus on trauma together in week two of this very important series in the season of Juneteenth. And we're so happy that you could join us. First, let's pray. Dear God, we give thanks for the rain, even as those suffer from drought. We ask you to be with them and to quench their thirst. We pray for new gun laws, even as those who suffer from the trauma of gun violence. We ask to show us the helpers, even when we look for you where people are suffering. And as you call us, help us to be those helpers. Amen. Today, I'm so happy to introduce to you and to meet in person Kimmy Carlos. Kimmy Carlos first came to my attention when, while working for the Mercer County, for the Mercer County programs that they provide each and every day, she talked about Amanda Gorman. This was in the middle of the pandemic, and she did an analysis of Amanda Gorman's extraordinary poem delivered during the Biden inauguration. Some of you may remember that. One line was, "When we hurt, we have hope." And then Kimmy spoke with us at the Mass Incarceration Task Force. That was also virtual. But today, we are fortunate to have her in person here at Nassau for our week two of adult ed. And we're so glad that you could join us, Kimmy. Kimmy Carlos is the CEO and founder of Kimmy Carlos Motivational Consulting. She's a co-founder and lead facilitator of Sister Wellness Retreats, Healing Spaces for Black Women, and author of The Window of Grace, Living in Recovery Through Christian Faith. She is also a candidate for ordination aspirant. She's with the Episcopal Diocese of New Jersey, and she works right here for the Alumni Corporation of Princeton University. Please give a warm welcome to Kimmy Carlos.
Thank you so much. I'm so delighted to be here. Can everybody hear me? Okay, I'm gonna just move this out the way a little bit so that everybody can actually see the screen. I'm so thrilled to be here and so excited for all the familiar faces that I haven't seen in a while. We're going to talk about mass incarceration and people of color, trauma in, trauma out. And as Marshall shared, really talking about what it means when we have community members that go away into our incarceration system literally for decades at a time. And what it looks like when they have been traumatized and that traumatic response is often criminalized. And then the trauma they experience when they come out of incarceration. This is normally a 90-minute presentation, so you're going to get highlights of what I typically teach on. But before I do, I want to share a little bit about myself so you understand why I'm so passionate about this work and specifically around trauma in Black, Brown, and impoverished communities. So as you heard, I am a trauma and alcoholism survivor, which is why I wrote my book, Window of Grace. This November will be 20 years I've been in recovery. From active alcoholism. I'm a published author, I'm a motivational speaker, I'm a master facilitator, which basically means I have a lot of certifications. I'm a wellness and empowerment coach through the Institute of Integrative Nutrition and a mental and emotional wellness advocate. I deeply believe in making our mental and emotional wellness your number one priority. I'm a nonprofit founder. I founded the Urban Mental Health Alliance, which is a mental health advocacy nonprofit, all volunteer in the city of Trenton. I am certified as a dismantling racism trainer through the New Jersey Episcopal Diocese. And I'm the proud daughter of 1968 Olympian Dr. John Carlos. Most people might not know that my dad at one time was considered the fastest man in the world, 1968 Olympian in Mexico City. But most people will remember him for this. That's my dad on the right-hand side. This was on the podium during the 1968 Summer Olympics in Mexico. My dad on the right, Dr. John Carlos, had just won the bronze. And my uncle, Tommy Smith, in the middle, had just won the gold. And Peter Norman, who I also claim as my other uncle, had just won second place with the silver. Peter Norman was from Australia. Most people call this the Black Power Salute, but in the Carlos family and in the Smith family, we call it the demonstration. My father was demonstrating for Black African Americans in Harlem, who were largely service workers in the 50s and 60s, who were making just barely minimum wage, trying to feed families. Tommy Smith was demonstrating for Black sharecroppers in the South, South Carolina, for the same thing. There was demonstrations going on all across Mexico City, but most people did not realize that because obviously this was the most prominent. Peter Norman was right in the middle of it. Peter Norman believed in the demonstrations. The only reason Peter Norman didn't have his hand in the air was because Peter did not have a glove at the time. But Peter believed in everything that my dad and Tommy Smith were demonstrating for. And when Peter went back to Australia, there was a lot of backlash against him. And they basically said, if you renounce Tommy and Johnny, then we'll accept you as our Olympian. He never did until the day he died. And I will always be indebted to him for that. People often ask why my father did that. And his response to this day is because he knew that while they were being renowned on the world stage, they were going to go back to a country that was going to still treat them as less than human. And he wanted the world to know that we needed to continue to fight for equity and social justice before equity and social justice were buzzwords. I call this picture holding the hand of grace, of greatness. This is my dad in 2019. My siblings and I, there's six of us all together, got together and threw my dad a surprise 50th anniversary gala to celebrate all the work that he has done as a social justice giant in the past 50 years. He had no idea that we were doing this. We just told him to show up in a tuxedo. It was a phenomenal event. This year, we went on to sit on the stage together for two events, one which was right here at Princeton University, the other one was at Trinity Cathedral in Trenton, to talk about the intersection of social justice and mental health. And that was, besides the birth of my children, the most glorious moment of my life to be on the stage with my dad. So I'm passionate about social justice because that is literally in my DNA. And my fight in social justice is around trauma, mental health, and mental illness in Black, Brown, and impoverished communities. So I want to thank you for being here because by virtue of the fact that you're in the room makes you a change maker. It means that you were interested in learning a different way of looking at the world and embracing the history in this country and thinking about how you can do things differently, how you can engage in the world in better ways. So I want to thank you for that, because there's a myriad of other things you could be doing with your time, and you chose to be here. I want you to know that this morning, these are the faces that we're talking about. These faces look like my grandchildren. This is where trauma starts. This is where trauma starts in impoverished communities, in oppressed and marginalized communities, which are largely Black, Brown communities. And when I say Black and Brown, I mean Black African American, Black Caribbean, Black European, Black immigrants, Black African, Latino, Latinx, East Asian, anything outside of considered quote unquote whiteness or people of color. These are the children. This is where the trauma starts. So if you're not familiar, I want to talk really quickly about adverse childhood experiences, traumatic events that can have negative lasting effects on health and well-being. I first learned about adverse childhood experiences about 10 years ago when I went to a conference, and a colleague said, come in this workshop with me so we can learn about this. To this day, I don't know whether or not that was wise of the facilitator, but she literally passed out the ACEs test to all the participants. And she said, fill this out. And it's a list of 10 top traumatic experiences that children usually experience in this country today. And it has to do with things like domestic violence, substance use disorder in the family, mental illness, parental separation or divorce, incarcerated parent, emotional abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse, neglect, emotional neglect, physical neglect. 10 questions. Of those 10, I had 9. Of those 10 questions, I had 9 in the affirmative that I had experienced. In fact, it brought back memories that I hadn't thought about in decades. The only one that I did not have, by the grace of God, I did not have a parent that had been incarcerated. But I did and do have a parent who died by suicide, and that was my mother. And it was at that time that I realized all this time it wasn't what was wrong with me, it was what had happened to me. What I had experienced and how those traumas put me into active alcoholism for more than 20 years. So when we look at this, we see people with 6 or more ACEs can die up to 20 years earlier in life. If we look at the development of a child who experiences an adverse childhood experience, how that disrupts neurological development, social, emotional, cognitive impairment, adoption of health risk behaviors, disease, disability, social problems, and early death. And it goes on to give you a myriad of other statistics, which you can look at, because I will share these slides. So if you look at this, you begin to understand where traumas begin. We often think of trauma in terms of one big traumatic event, but these are ongoing traumas that the children in our communities often experience. So often that in our communities, these traumas are normally normalized. But if you look a little closer when it comes to ACEs, and you look at that household tree, this is where we play righteous politics. And we say, well, if they could get their act together, and it wouldn't be so much divorce, and you wouldn't have family members in prison, and there wouldn't be any domestic violence or gang warfare or drug warfare, and children wouldn't feel bullied, and they wouldn't feel neglected, and they wouldn't get into drugs, if the parents and the communities could just figure it out. But we often don't look at the roots of this tree, which is in the community where we have historical trauma, substandard schools, which we know is based on our very flawed tax system, lack of social capital and mobility, poor water and air quality, which is environmental injustice, violence, street violence, domestic violence, strategic intentional violence, structural racism, poverty, substandard wages where you are either unemployed or underemployed, where you're working 2 or 3 jobs and you're still not making enough to feed your family, lack of job availability, and poor housing quality and affordability, where there's actually a lack of housing, and often housings do not have heat and air conditioning, or you're dealing with environmental issues like mold, varmint infestation, no elevators, broken windows. So when you think about those things, and then you couple that with a lot of our environmental injustices where we know the poorest and the brownest and the blackest communities are ones that suffer the most when we have environmental disasters. So if you think of ACEs in terms of social justice and think of ACEs in terms of the way certain systems and structures are built and sustained to keep people in poverty, to keep people in marginalization and oppression, we begin to understand where those traumas came from, and we begin to understand that it's not what's wrong with little black and brown children, it is what has happened to them. If we wonder why a lot of black and brown boys and girls end up in prison or in gangs or homeless or on substances, it has a lot to do with poverty and oppression. That's a pretty heavy weight to carry around at such a young age. And when we think of that pyramid and we understand the neurological disruptions and the impairments, we begin to realize why some decisions from the outside don't make sense to us, but perhaps made sense to a mind that's been traumatized? How does our discriminatory criminal justice system affect children, looking at black children and looking at white children? One in four black children actually have a parent or a caregiver in prison versus one in 25. That has nothing to do with the child. It often has nothing to do with the parent or the caregiver, but it has to do with the systems that we work within and the fact that our incarceration systems are for profit. If we're gonna narrow the achievement gap, we need to look at fixing our criminal justice system. I wanna talk about the adultification and criminalization of black children. I wanna talk about the fact that often when we look at little black faces like this, we don't see children. We see adults. We see threats. We see intimidation. We see, what are they gonna grow up to do that's gonna harm me or harm our society? And that's whether we consciously or unconsciously understand that, that's what we've been socialized to believe. Through things like this. Just subtle nuances and biases that we have. Noting that in the Associated Press, 18-year-old Michael Brown was an 18-year-old black man, while 18-year-old Peyton Gendron is a white teenager. We adultify black children. We don't see them as children. I snatched this off of Facebook. If the police in my suburban white neighborhood had regularly stopped and frisked my white friends, think Princeton, Hopewell, Inglewood, half of them would be in prison for drug possession, but they didn't. So we went to prison while black children in the city, think Trenton, Elizabeth, Rahway, Camden, Newark, where I went to college. So we went to college while black kids in the city went to prison. The war on drugs put more young black and brown men and women in prison than any other time, at the height of when incarceration was for profit. One in three African-American men and one in 17 white men have a chance of going to prison during their lifetimes. If you haven't had a chance to read The New Jim Crow, I encourage you to read it, and we'll talk more about that in the next few minutes. So when we look at the figures overall, one in nine men in general, one in 17 white men, one in three black men, one in six Latinx men, all women, one in 56, white women, one in 111, black women, one in 18, Latinx women, one in 45. This is by design. It's not that black women and black men and Latino Latinx women and Latino Latinx men commit more crimes. We're human beings. Everybody has the capacity to be criminal and to be violent and to commit crimes. But we work in a system that A, does not see black and brown people as fully human, and B, that's designed to have as many bodies in prisons as possible. And often those people who fall into the criminal justice system were criminalized because of whatever traumatic behaviors they may have been displaying. Case in point, the crack cocaine epidemic was criminalized. And there are more people in prison with substance use disorder because of that. But when we started looking at what was happening with the meth epidemic, then it became a health crisis. Because now we're talking about white suburbs and white rural areas and white people that are dying from it. We criminalize behaviors that are really traumatic response behaviors. When we think about the adultification and the sexualization of black girls and brown girls, especially Latino, Latinx, we view them as little women who are somehow little taunts, little tramps that are doing the things that they're doing to try and get their way, to supersede the system. We don't see them as children. If you think about what Ruby Bridges went through to be a change maker at that young age, the physical and verbal and emotional abuse that she suffered. And if you ask yourself, why would they do that to a little girl? Because they didn't see her as a little girl. As tiny as she is, she wasn't viewed as a little girl. She was viewed as a threat. Clearly, Ruby Bridges grew up to be beautiful and intelligent and resilient and powerful and a change maker in her own right. But the trauma that she went through, because a system taught those people that were so angry about her integrating to school that she was not a little girl looking for an education. She's a threat to their way of life. Want to read a great article? How We Make Black Girls Grow Up Too Fast. I wanted to make sure that this article was still available, so I went online and pulled it up a couple days ago and read through it. It is, and I strongly encourage you to read it. So when you think about trauma, stressors on diverse ethnic racial groups has everything to do with poverty, systemic racism, discrimination, and violence. Members of ethnic and racial minority groups in the U.S. face a social and economic environment of inequality that includes greater exposure to racism, discrimination, violence, and poverty, all of which take a toll on mental health. So for those of you who know me in the room, I am extremely passionate about mental health. I came into mental health advocacy because of my own journey in active alcoholism. And I knew that if I was going to get sober, I had to wrap my head around the PTSD and the depression and the social anxiety that I had been living with, right? Because as long as I was drinking, I didn't feel any of that. And that's how I kind of stumbled into mental health advocacy, because I realized that in black and brown communities, we really weren't talking about this. But it wasn't until more than a decade later when I took anti-racism training. And believe me, I went into that training kicking and screaming because I thought, who's going to teach me about racism? Have you looked at me lately? But it was when I took that class, I realized that racism is not about black folks and brown folks and white folks. Systemic racism is about systems and infrastructures and barriers and policies that sustain those who have privilege and oppress and marginalize those who don't have privilege. And when I took that training, I realized that I no longer had to be angry at people that didn't look like me, because that's not what racism is. And that's where I found my sweet spot, the intersection between mental health and systemic racism, and understanding that if we're going to really be change makers in this country, or even just in our little communities, we have to recognize the true dragon in the room, which is the systems and the policies that we keep building and sustaining and maintaining that give some privilege and others marginalization. So if we're going to talk about trauma, let's talk about simple PTSD related to a single event, a car accident, a sexual assault, losing a job, suddenly losing a family member, the pandemic, versus complex PTSD where we see sustained traumas again and again and again because of systems that are designed to marginalize. And how we have black and brown children that grow up in that type of trauma again and again, and are expected to function as productive adults in society, and are penalized when they literally are unable to do that. And we begin to understand that we have whole communities that are struggling with complex PTSD. And then we, as a country, go into those communities and scoop up as many people as we can and throw them into for-profit prisons. And we forget that we're dealing with humanity. So think specifically about two types of trauma. I want you to think about racial trauma, also known as race-based traumatic stress, refers to the stressful impact of emotional pain of one's experience with racism and discrimination. Common traumatic stress reactions that reflect racial trauma include increased vigilance. Why would you kill somebody who stepped on your foot? And suspicion, increased sensitivity to threat, sense of a foreshortened future. We have children in our communities in Trenton that can't even envision going to college because they're not sure they're going to live that long, because gun violence in Trenton is so rampant. And maladaptive responses to stress, such as aggression or substance use. Further racial trauma can have a negative impact on individuals' physical and mental health, including negative and depressive symptoms and hypertension and coronary heart disease, which is why we have family members in our communities who are dying in their 40s and 50s and 60s. Transgenerational trauma, also known as intergenerational trauma, is a psychological theory which suggests that trauma can be transferred in between generations. After a first generation of survivors experience trauma, they're able to transfer their trauma to their children and further generations of offspring via complex post-traumatic stress disorder mechanisms. This field of research is relatively young, but has been expanded in recent years. And we came to understand transgenerational trauma because of what our Jewish brothers and sisters went through. But as we continue to do the work, we begin to realize that this same type of trauma is passed down to the generations in Black African-American communities because of the enslavement in our country. And it's also passed down in our immigrant communities because of the way we treat immigrants coming from South America. But we often don't recognize this type of trauma. One of my personal heroes, Archbishop Desmond Tutu. I was devastated when he passed because I had this fantasy that one day I would meet him. He says, there comes a point where we need to stop just pulling people out of the river. We need to go upstream and find out why they're falling in. And this is a very simple quote, but he was speaking in a much larger context, obviously about apartheid South Africa. So I want to talk real quickly about what an advocate and an ally is versus a change maker. An advocate is a person who publicly supports or recommends a particular cause or policy. He was an untiring advocate of economic reform. I'm a strong advocate for our LGBTQ plus communities, especially in our Black and brown communities, especially in our youth communities. An ally, a person, group, or nation that is associated with another or others for some common cause or purpose. I am an ally to our indigenous communities. I believe that they are the original sin in this country, and I support their fight. Because while Black African Americans were a fraction of a person in the Constitution, our indigenous communities never even made it into the Constitution because the belief was that we would eliminate them all and we would build a new country. But a change maker is different. A change maker is a person who desires change in the world and by gathering knowledge and resources makes that change happen. A person who's taking creative action, strategic and intentional action to solve a social problem. A change maker gives themselves permission to do something about a social problem and keeps trying until they've made a difference. When I first started talking about mental health, folks in the Black community didn't want to talk about it. My dad, who's my greatest hero in the world, said, don't talk about that. Do you know whose daughter you are? My stepmother was like, please don't go around talking about that. You're not an alcoholic. We don't have alcoholics in this family. And so if I had been waiting for their permission, I would have never been able to do this work. So I went to my pastor at the time. He didn't want to talk about it. Went to my siblings, they didn't want to talk about it. Went to my friends, nobody wanted to talk about this, which is how I ended up at the National Alliance of Mental Illness because they were talking about it. And they were delighted to see this Black woman walk through the door asking questions because I gave myself permission, not that I was anything important, but I was determined because I had made a covenant with God that if you sustain me, I'll stay sober. And he connected me with a community who embraced me and who empowered me to learn about this. And that's when I decided, before I even knew the word change maker, that there had to be a change in Black and brown communities because we were talking about this and people were still dying by suicide and drug overdose and gang warfare and drug warfare and street violence. So when you're a change maker, you say, even though I'm swimming upstream, I'm going to work to make a difference. Changemakers are disruptors. They are not disruptive. They are disruptors. They disrupt systems that oppress and marginalize. They disrupt systems that create privilege and oppression. Our very own Professor Ruha Benjamin, tenured professor of African American Studies and Sociology at Princeton U. She says, remember to imagine and craft the world you cannot live without, just as you dismantle the ones you cannot live within. So people say, well, this is the way we've always done it. We're kind of comfortable here. It works for us. And you know what? I'm also a person of privilege. The fact that I'm a cisgendered woman gives me privilege. The fact that I'm a Christian gives me privilege. The fact that I have clean running water and air conditioning when it's 100 degrees and heat when it's 2 degrees. The fact that I have a running car. The fact that I can afford a car. All this gives me privilege. The fact that I could go to college and get a degree. The fact that I walk around with the full use of my brain and my arms and my legs and all of my 5 senses, all of that gives me privilege. But I will never have the privilege of not having gone to prison because I was white, or a whole host of other privileges that come with quote unquote whiteness. So what Ruha is telling us is while we dismantle the systems that don't work, we need to build those systems that are equitable. And there's a myriad of ways that we can do that. By strengthening economic supports in families and changing social norms to support parents and positive parenting and provide quality care and education in early life and enhancing parenting skills to promote healthy child development in communities where they've not seen healthy parenting because of all of the systems that have prevented them from being able to do that, and intervening to lessen harm and prevent future risk. These are all ways that we can begin to build that better world that Archbishop Desmond Tutu and Ruha Benjamin and our poet laureate Amanda Gorman talks about. My favorite quote from Amanda Gorman is she says, we are an unfinished country. We're unfinished. We're young and we're arrogant. We are unfinished. And what unfinished means is that we have great potential and we have lots of growth. We're still early in this fight. Changemakers seek to learn and understand. Read, listen, watch all the things. Seek credible sources, suspend personal beliefs, and learn with empathy. And mind you, when I teach the longer 90 minutes, we go deep into this slide. So I know I'm just skimming the top of this. But I'm going to share with you some great resources. And again, I'll give these slides to Marshall. Post-Mac Slave Syndrome, Dr. George DeGroote is a giant. If you want to understand the way the Black African-American brain works when it has been traumatized and how those traumatic behaviors are passed down literally through the womb in DNA as well as modeled normalized traumatic behaviors, read this book. Resurrection Hope, Reverend Canon Kelly Brown Douglas, does a phenomenal job explaining what anti-Black racism means. In other words, why do we all, including people of color, so including me, have the embedded and biased belief that somehow Black African Americans and anybody else who's of color are less than when compared to whiteness? If you want to understand more about adverse childhood experiences, jump into The Deepest Well, Healing from the Long-Term Effects of Childhood Adversity. Dr. Nadine Burke Harris, also a giant pediatric, and was also the first surgeon general in California, I believe. Phenomenal book. If you're like me, who doesn't have a lot of time, and it seems like the older I get, the shorter my patience get, so it's hard for me to actually sit and read a book, I do everything on Audible, including all my textbooks. And of course, The Body Keeps the Score, which talks about what happens physically in the brain, in the body, and in the mind of those who have suffered trauma, any type of trauma. Excellent book. Heavy book, again, do it on Audible. And finally, The New Jim Crow. Michelle Alexander, another giant, I'm sure all of you know, another heavy book. But if you really want to understand mass incarceration and understand prisons for profit, read this book. And finally, these are my grandchildren. They are 4 of the 6. Somehow God decided to give me, this broken vessel, the favor of 2 children who grew up for the majority of their childhood with a dysfunctional alcoholic mother, but somehow they grew up healthy, they got married, and both of them gave me, between the two of them, 6 grandchildren. That's Ariana on the left, who is now 13. That's Niana next to her, who is now 11. Tony Jr., who is now also 13. And Zachariah, who is 10. So they're much bigger now. But they love me unconditionally. I consider that one of my blessings because I uphold the covenant that I made with God. But if you look at the statistics, one of my six grandchildren is going to end up in prison, probably more. One of my six grandchildren could potentially become addicted to substances. One of my six grandchildren could die by gunfire. One of my six grandchildren could end up homeless. Just looking at the statistics. Even though I worked hard in corporate America, I wasn't sober half the time, but I was there every day working hard in corporate America to feed my children and make sure they grew up in a suburb where they were good at good education. But looking at statistics, it's still easy for them to get swept up. So they are the reason that I wake up every day and do this work. They are the reason, as I told Marshall, when people call me, the word no literally gets stuck in my throat. Because I believe I was created to have this tough conversation with people like yourself who are change makers and who want to see an ideal world. And with that, I thank you.
Thank you, Timmy. Thank you very much. We have to leave at 9:45, but we have 5 minutes. We have time for a couple of questions. Does anybody have a question for Kimmy?
I should probably put this back on.
Yes.
Do you think that's a trend, or was that an exception to what appears to be a trend to address some of these issues?
That's a great question. So, no, it's not a trend. There has always been resistance to systemic racism, marginalization, oppression, right? There's always been a segment of this population who has power in their whiteness, in their prominence, in their, you know, financial ability to be able to disrupt systems that might make things uncomfortable for them. Okay? So this is not new. However, I do believe that we are growing and changing as a country. I do believe that the smallest segment that has power realizes that we're growing and changing. I believe that the horses out of the barn. We are becoming a predominantly black and brown country, and we do have more civil rights today than ever before. Even though we see this really ferocious fight to dismantle and turn back the clock, we are making progress. We're making progress in communities like this, where people on grassroots on the floor saying, let's make changes in our community, let's look at our policies. But what happens is, in social media and the media in general, when we see things like what happened in San Francisco, we say, oh my God, the sky is falling. But it's not, because what happened in San Francisco goes on all across the country, and this is not new. The ridiculousness we see going on in Florida, the ridiculousness we see going on in Texas, none of this is new. The only thing that's different is that when people would go in the streets and march and rally, there would be fire hoses and rifles and people would be killed on the spot. We don't do that so much today, which means we've made progress. But as the Right Reverend Dean Rene Rory said, who's the rector at my church, he said it takes time to change the direction of a large vessel. And we're getting there, but it's very slow, which is why I said we're real early in this fight. And I've already told my children and my grandchildren, I said, I'm not going to see the ideal world that I'm fighting for you, but I believe in planting this tree so that you can sit under the shade. So I'm not going to see what I'm fighting for, but they'll see it, and their kids and their grandkids will see it. And so while it's moving very slow and while we're disheartened when we see what happens in San Francisco, it's not new, but it also does not deter us. As we say in a black church, we ain't no ways tired. Yes, ma'am.
Some of those who are against gun control argue for more mental health issues, about mental health issues and
In my personal opinion, it does not. Do we have people that pick up guns and a whole host of other weapons because they're dealing with mental health issues? Yes, we do. But I also believe that we, again, have a tendency to criminalize anything that we're uncomfortable with, right? And so when we do that, we're promoting the fact that we think all mentally ill people are violent, right? And that's not the case, okay? That's number one. Number two, when we hear people do that, what we're watching is two things. Number one, gaslighting, and number two, bait and switch, right? Don't look at the issue that's over here. We're gonna play politics and say it's their fault, and if they could just fix this, then we can keep our guns. But in my personal opinion, I cannot think of any justifiable reason why a person needs an AR-15. That's my personal opinion. I cannot imagine, unless you are literally going to war, I cannot imagine why you would need that. And I cannot imagine how it would get in the hands of a person who is clearly unstable. That doesn't mean that they're necessarily mentally ill, but they're unstable. Would get in the hands of being able to literally slaughter people. But what's interesting is that we see this in Trenton every day. And we see it in Newark every day. And we see it in Atlantic City and Camden and Los Angeles, which is where I grew up, every day. And in Chicago, every day. Nobody talks about it until it's a mass murder. So gun laws have to change regardless of who picks up the gun, whether they're mentally ill or not. If we're going to work towards that ideal world, we have to make sure that we're building equity for everybody, whether they're black in Trenton or white in Princeton or brown in Uvalde, Texas. There needs to be equity across the table where we decide as a country that we want a better world for everybody who occupies this space. And until we get there, unfortunately, we're going to keep losing people. On a smaller scale, where there's one black parent in Trenton grieving, and on a large scale where you have 30 and 40 parents grieving whole classrooms of children that have been murdered.
One more question.
Yes, and so that's one of the things that just makes my heart swell, and I'll talk real fast, Marshall. But that's what makes my heart swell. I'm working on an initiative now, and this is gonna sound haughty. I'm working on an initiative now to build what somebody said to me is 20 Kimmys in the community. Because I've become known in Trenton as A, the mental health lady, and B, a safe person. So everybody in Trenton, and largely Mercer County, has my personal cell and my email. And I am not exaggerating when I say I have between 5 to 7 people a week who hit me with a voicemail or a text message or track me down on Facebook Messenger or LinkedIn or Instagram or wherever they can get to me, because my uncle, my son, my daughter, my goddaughter, my niece, and I don't know what to do, and I don't know who to talk to. But because I did what my dad told me, who's now one of my biggest fans and my greatest supporter when it comes to mental health work, he said to me, the way you get into Trenton and any other city is that you remain integrity filled and you remain consistent. So even though nobody wants to talk about it, you just keep talking to them the way you kept talking to me. And they're gonna see that you are a voice and you're a safe person. So people call me because they know that they can talk to me about being depressed or dealing with alcoholism or the domestic violence that has them depressed in their homes or whatever it is, because I'm not gonna judge them, I'm not gonna humiliate them. I'm gonna be a conduit to get them to resources, and I'm gonna hold everything they say to me in confidence. The only person I take it to is God, right? And if we could build 20 more Kimmys like that to be ambassadors in the community, right? So in answer to your question, yes. If I, as one person, can shift the way people think about mental health in Trenton, where I have pastors and nonprofit executive directors calling me and asking my opinion, me who has no certification and who's trying to stay sober every day, obviously I've built a shift in the thought in the community for people to say, it's safe for us to talk about this. If we could somehow build 20 more of me who literally stumbled into this. I did not wake up 10 years ago or 15 years ago when I first came to Trenton and said, I'm going to be the advocate. I just kept talking. If we could have 20 more people that just keep talking and are safe people, we could make even greater change.
Thank you, Kimmy. Thank you, everyone, for coming out today. For more information from Kimmy, you have her email, kimmycarlos@gmail.com. For her PowerPoint, reach out to me through the Nassau website. I'm Marshall McKnight. And we're so glad you could join us this morning at this early meeting time for adult education. Next week, we're back to our 11:15 starting time, where we'll hear from Anton Henshaw. Anton is a 30-year juvenile lifer. He founded Transformative Justice, and he'll be talking about helping the formerly incarcerated find their way home. We hope you can join us. Thanks, everyone.